it's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast. Okay, we're joined here today with somebody that is organizing around the Atlantic Coast Pipeline and also the Mountain Valley Pipeline, also referred to as the ACP or MVP. And we're going to be talking a lot about these pipelines, what they mean, how people are organizing against them. Right now, there's a series of meetings that will kind of determine how this struggle plays out. But real quick, do you want to introduce yourself a little bit and just tell people where you're coming from?
Sure. I live in Richmond, Virginia. I've been working on pipeline resistance to these two pipelines specifically for the past 4 years, working with a number of different groups in the state and the region.
Okay. And just to get us started, I mean, today there was an article that just came out. A Kinder Morgan pipeline just blew up, killing several people. They said the flames went up for about 100 feet. Some residents reported that, quote, they weren't sure if a bomb went off. And a few weeks ago, as I'm sure you were aware, there was a major pipeline leak as the Keystone XL was being voted on. I'm just curious, you know, what is your response and analysis of this as somebody that looks at this stuff a lot? I mean, hearing about these things blowing up and leaking, just what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, first off, you know, it's sad to hear that, unfortunately, that there were these explosions and these leaks. But on the other hand, you know, we all saw it coming. So it's, you know, what words are there to have when destruction like this happens? And I think it really just underscores the point that water and land defenders are making now in, you know, these fights against the Atlantic Coast and Mountain Valley and all the other pipelines that, you know, keep it in the ground. We don't need any more pipelines.
Well, we're going to talk about the history of the struggle against the ACP and the MVP in a second, but I'm just curious if you can give us an overview, pretty much the broad strokes of just specifically this pipeline battle. You know, what is it, what's at stake, and who are the big players involved?
Sure. So I'll start with the Mountain Valley Pipeline. Mountain Valley is a 303-mile pipeline running from West Virginia through the Appalachian Mountains down into Southwest Virginia, and is slated to eventually connect with the Transco pipeline, or Transcontinental Pipeline. It's a $3.5 billion project, and that's being developed by EQT Corporation, which is based in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And so those that may not be familiar with Southwest Virginia or kind of Appalachia geography, there's lots of karst terrain, over 500 perennial water bodies, along with some various endangered and protected species that are at risk just from this pipeline, not to mention all the people agricultural land in the pathway.
Right, and we're going to talk a little bit about how that impacts people in the path of the pipelines in a little bit. But there was an article that was published in mid-November at the Huffington Post that referred to the AVP as the Atlantic Trump Pipeline. Why is this? How is there a connection between a pipeline on the East Coast and Donald Trump?
Sure. So basically, just after Trump took office, he came out, you know, released his list of top domestic priorities, As we know, he had already been talking about allowing the Dakota Access Pipeline and had to continue and had made references to the Keystone XL as well. And so the Atlantic Coast Pipeline was in this list of top 50 domestic priorities. So being one of the pipelines that some folks have called this the Keystone of the East Coast for different reasons, both in the scale of the Atlantic Coast, which is 600 miles, currently slated to go through three states, West Virginia, Virginia, and North Carolina, possibly South Carolina. So this is a really huge pipeline, a 42-inch pipe. And so Trump came out and explicitly said that this was something that, that he wanted to push through or get pushed through. So that's kind of how it relates to Trump, along with his recent appointment of two additional board members to FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. So that's kind of how it relates to Trump. He's basically made his endorsement from day one.
Well, in the same article, it states from December 6th to 12th, Virginia's State Water Control Board will hold public hearings on whether to allow the 600-mile, $5.5 billion ACP and the 300-mile, $3.5 billion MVP pipeline in. So what is happening right now? I mean, today is December 6th. Going on for the next several days, there's going to be this meeting. How are people responding, and what will actually be decided at these meetings?
Sure. So this is the Virginia State Water Control Board, which is reviewing comments around the Section 401 of the Clean Water Act. And it's a very specific part of the permitting process, which, you know, this whole struggle has really forced landowners, activists, and organizers to, you know, become experts in our own right of the processes and everything that's going on. So what they're focusing on is in these meetings, which did, as you mentioned, started today, is specifically around upland areas that could impact water quality. So not specifically individual water crossings or sedimentation or erosion control, but really just like construction activities that are happening in upland areas that could affect water quality throughout the affected areas. So it's a very specific part of the process, but it where we are now, this is also the kind of last part in the permitting process. Yeah. Both pipelines got the Army Corps of Engineer permits this past spring, and the FERC decisions were handed down in the late evening of Friday, October 13th. So it kind of, they tried to sneak it by some folks. So we're now at the final stages of this permitting process. But in other ways, kind of the beginning of what may be some larger direct action campaigns.
Right. So these are mostly for show, these kind of hearings. I mean, they've already made their decision, essentially, is what you're saying.
Pretty much. I mean, that's what we think. I was just reviewing the draft permits, the way that the department, the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality works is, you know, they work with the pipeline companies from the beginning. And so they've been drafting the legislation, essentially, or the permits language. And so they've been going back and forth to make it fit, essentially. So the board hearings are saying, like, you know, you can't provide any new comments. Do you have a comment on something that's already been said or made? Mm-hmm. And from folks that were at the meeting today, you know, it seemed that the board members seemed bored. Go figure. So, you know, and not they think everyone has their mind made up to have these pipelines passed, unfortunately.
Well, there was mass opposition to the Dakota Access Pipeline. There was mass opposition to the Keystone XL. Obviously, people on the ground are upset about these things. As we talked about at the start of the program, these pipelines blow up and kill people. And, you know, realistically, the money that's being made for these things is not trickling down or going to the people that live around these areas. So why is it the elites want to push through these pipelines so bad? Why is it so integral to their economy or their overall project?
Right. So, you know, we can think about the kind of larger global energy markets, if you will. You know, oil production is down. The United Snakes have been involved in oil wars for at least the past 10 years. You know, so you could consider it more going back to, you know, the first Gulf War, probably even further. But so, you know, Trump and his business partners and the other elites see fracked gas as a way out to produce a domestic energy source with revenue. So they can profit off of that. And so we've seen this play out, you know, with the construction of export facilities, like at Cove Point, Maryland, where they liquefy the natural gas, the fracked gas, to ship it over to India and Japan, because they can't produce all the, you know, energy needs, that they have there because, you know, all these companies and energy companies will, you know, actively suppress the development of clean, renewable energy. So that's one part of it. Well, the, you know, kind of the bigger picture. And the whole narrative from Dominion Energy and Duke Energy, the two main partners behind the Atlantic Coast, they try to say that this is all for domestic production, and domestic use, which we know isn't exactly true. And they say that energy demands in our area are going up, significantly in the next 20 years. There have been additional studies to show that that's false. It's more flat or even declining in some areas. So it's really all about profit, you know. It's about profit, and they don't care about what happens to the land or the water in the meantime.
Right, and there's also no an abundance of oil currently right now, too. It's not like if these pipelines weren't built that somehow the United States would run out of oil. Not that that would necessarily be a bad thing, of course, but does that make sense? I mean, like, I guess the other question is, like, why produce more and more oil, especially at a time when gas is so cheap?
Right. And that's their idea, is that gas is really cheap. You know, the research and extraction methods for fracking have the cost for that has gone down. So in these in the eyes of the capitalist, it makes more sense. They know the terrain because they live in the so-called United States or Canada. And so it's easier to extract, to store and distribute from their home turf, as opposed to relying on pipelines in the Middle East, in Iraq, Syria, Saudi Arabia, and then you also have Russia and the stands, all the pipelines from like Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and we've seen China really expanding their economic influence as well with their new Silk Road of the 21st century. So the U.S. and the U.S. and their corporate elites are really having, you know, they do face some challenges globally in that sense. But we know in the end, it's all for profit, and they just swap bonuses back and forth. So that's why they're trying to, you know, expand production in the United States.
Well, thanks for sharing. That was a good insight. So what are the ways that human beings and communities are impacted by these pipelines? I mean, kind of laying aside the obvious environmental impacts, but I mean, like, as far as eminent domain, public lands, people's houses, as well as, you know, threats to water and stuff like that.
Sure. So from the beginning of the announcement of these pipelines and the resistance to them, landowners, and I'll speak specifically from Virginia since that's where I live and have done most of this work from and in, but a lot of landowners have either refused access to surveyors and are also refusing to sell their land or their easements to Dominion Energy for these pipelines. And so what we have now is that Dominion, the ACP, which is a LLC, a limited liability corporation formed by Dominion and its partners, they are suing these landowners who have refused to give up their land. And so they're suing them and, you know, pursuing an eminent domain case. At the same time, over 500 landowners are suing Dominion and the ACP and the MVP. So there are a couple legal irons in the fire on that sense, which is really awesome. There were several action camps and training camps earlier this summer to provide landowners and activists additional skills and training in outdoors activities, we'll call it. And so these were some really great ways to connect folks from the urban and rural settings together and trade ideas and information with each other. So those legal battles are happening. And on the eminent domain front, another big thing for Virginia is for the Atlantic coast, there are three compressor stations slated for this pipeline, bigger than any that Dominion has ever built, given the size and length of the pipeline. And so one for each state, essentially. And so in Virginia, their proposed compressor station location is in the heart of Virginia in Buckingham County, specifically in a neighborhood that is 85% Black or African-American. It's called Union Hill. And these are descendants of freed people who bought their land from former plantation owners and their descendants. So this is a strong community that is mostly Black. So it's a clear instance of eco-racism. And, you know, they're all in the blast zone. And we know from other instances that compressor stations regularly have what's called a blowdown, which emits loud noises and gases. It's basically releasing excess pressure from the pipeline. And so all these residents and neighbors have the potential to be affected by that and the potential to be incinerated if, you know, this pipeline explodes. You know, we all expect it to leak. Mm-hmm. We hope it doesn't explode.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, with that in mind, let's talk about the resistance so far to these pipelines. Can you just tell us a little history about what have people done in the face of these projects?
Yeah. So, I mean, resistance really has started from day one. Different grassroots as well as nonprofit groups have been organizing around these pipelines. And I've got to say, I always got to hand it out to the landowners who live in the route of the pipeline. They've been going at it hard from day one, just doing this research, really connecting with each other and forming these networks of mutual aid and assistance, you know, calling each other when they see surveyors coming down the road and, you know, kind of spontaneously forming a blockade on someone's land or on the road to prevent these surveyors on. You know, there've been series and series of marches and protests. There have been things like, you know, different awareness campaigns where there is some folks did a bicycle ride along the route of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. There was several week march or walk along the pipeline route. There have been kayak flotillas down the James River and all sorts of things like that. There have been several really large marches and gatherings for the pipelines and, you know, related coal ash issues here in Richmond. Just most recently, this past Saturday, which was the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, CCAN, along with Bold Alliance and Blue Ridge Environmental Defense League and other kind of county groups, hosted a big Water is Life rally down at the Capitol. They had over 500, close to 800 folks come into town, and they circled the state capitol, you know, chanting Water is Life, demanding that the Governor McAuliffe and the newly elected Ralph Northam rescind these permits, reject these pipelines. And then they continue to celebrate with each other in the resistance that we've had so far, and really build more energy for the upcoming resistance, which we know will be long and hard, hopefully short and easy. But given the history of other pipeline fights, we're expecting a fight. Folks are gearing up. Folks that I've worked with, this summer, we hosted direct action strategy, workshops throughout the state, talking with landowners and other organizers and activists to, you know, really think strategically and how we implement, these different tactics, to get the best results. So folks are really gearing up for the next phase of this struggle, and we're asking everyone to help as much as we can.
Awesome. Well, hopefully IGD can play a role in signal boosting and being a grassroots media resource when all that stuff does go down. But I'm just curious now to kind of switch gears and kind of pick your brain about the wider anti-pipeline movement. You know, it's interesting when the encampment started at Standing Rock. I mean, it was very much out of the media, mm-hmm. and it was kind of this slow boil of more and more people coming, more and more people getting involved until, you know, it just couldn't be ignored anymore. How would you evaluate the state of the anti-pipeline movement in general, if that's even the right term to use, or the struggle against extractive industry, you know, going into 2018?
Man, I mean, I think we've all had a lot of ups and downs. And I think it's tough to really separate the pipeline struggles from these other struggles that a lot of us are involved in terms of anti-fascist and anti-racist struggles, healthcare, all these sorts of things. So I think it's, on one hand, it's hard to separate these out, but I'll try to keep it to pipelines. I think as a whole, I think we're really strong. And specifically for these pipelines and the ACP especially, the companies are scared, man. They are so scared. Dominion has been pumping up this fake shadow front group for all its PR campaigns, trying to basically inflating numbers and trying to get regulators to think that people actually want these pipelines, and it's just totally false.
Just to hold you up there, that's really interesting. Can you just explain that a little more? What does that actually mean?
Yeah, so there's this group called Your Energy, which is basically a PR. It's a PR bus for Dominion Resources and the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. There's some really interesting articles that came out in the Washington Post, and I think another one on Huffington Post as well. But basically, Dominion has been calls it their grassroots campaign to elect a pipeline. So this group has been, you know, just pouring tons and tons of money into radio commercial, TV commercials, ads on Facebook and, you know, around the internet to just really pump a lot of propaganda, pro-pipeline propaganda out there. And it's all happening kind of here at the end. And so in those articles I just mentioned, reporters were able to get hold of a PowerPoint presentation that kind of outlined their thinking around their propaganda to support pipelines. So I really recommend checking that out. And I think it gives a good insight into them, you know, and the way that these extraction companies are thinking and the way that they're feeling. You know, they feel behind the ball, essentially. And so they're trying to catch up through these like, you know, quote unquote slick stuff. But at the same time, you know, we do see state repression also trying to clamp down, as we've seen in the J20 trials, which are still going on, just started really, you know, with the charges of conspiracy and rioting, conspiracy to riot, and with the Tiger Swan documents and actions that we saw out at Standing Rock. We know Tiger Swan was up at Camp White Pine in Pennsylvania. And so on the one hand, the Justice Department or Injustice Department is trying to clamp down on resistors and agitators and create a stronger legal framework for their repression. But I think on the corporate side, they're feeling really scared. And the Atlantic Coast and the Mountain Valley are already at least 1 year behind schedule. And time is money, you know. So the longer we can delay it and resist, the more money we can cost them, and the sooner we can stop the pipelines. So,
and they're scared because they know that there's so much opposition, or they're scared because they can see things like Standing Rock taking place, or the fact that there's literally pipeline battles happening across the country, you know, being waged by not only environmentalists, anarchists, indigenous people, but also just everyday people that live in the path of the pipeline. I mean,
I think it's both. They're not necessarily mutually exclusive. And I think that's been something really awesome to see develop around here in these struggles, in that over the past 4 years, we, all the folks kind of working on this, have very intentionally tried to form those connections and strengthen those relationships between, you know, us city kids and the landowners who live on the path of the pipeline, or who live and the pipeline is trying to cross them, as well as different folks from indigenous communities, you know, people of color, black folks, in the line of destruction. And so we've been really intentional about forming those connections in our resistance here in Virginia. Right. So that's been really, really awesome to see.
It's interesting correlation. I don't know if you've had a chance to read the review that a former U.S. attorney made of the Charlottesville demonstrations on August 12th, the so-called Unite the Right rally. But, you know, one of the things that they write about in analyzing and reviewing the response from law enforcement to these alt-right white supremacist rallies is they say over and over again that the biggest thing the government did wrong is that it caused a lack of trust, or, you know, created an air of illegitimacy of the state and of the police themselves. And it's funny because, you know, I need to go back and read it myself, but my impression of reading it is that, you know, what they say in the end was that, you know, there needs to be more counterinsurgency, more police, more coordination with state forces to make sure these disorders don't happen again. But it's this really kind of you know, two-pronged thing where it's like they're really worried about how they appear to people, but at the same time, they also recognize that the only thing they really have to play is just naked state violence.
Right. I just looked up and the Crime Think zine is staring in front of me. The illegitimacy of violence, the violence of legitimacy. So, yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting point in that. You know, we know both on July 8th, the KKK rally in Charlottesville, and August 12th, the state and the police, they were not coordinated at all, both, you know, between city police and state police and all the other agencies. They were not talking to each other. And for A12 specifically, you know, activists and organizers told them, like, yo, if you let these Nazis into town, like, people are going to get hurt, but people are going to get killed. And so they didn't listen, obviously. And so I think on the one hand, it's, you know, it's definitely good for us that consider ourselves anarchists and revolutionaries that the state is losing some, you know, image of legitimacy. And I think that really opens up spaces for, you know, your more, what you might call an everyday person to really see the contradictions inherent in the system. So I think that's a positive, despite the, you know, the unfortunate, you know, the death of Heather Heyer and the, you know, ongoing grand jury investigations and so on. So it's, yeah, it's a weird, you know, it's going to get, the state's going to try to strengthen itself while it's also losing legitimacy. And so I don't, it's a balancing act for all of us, I think.
Well, just to kind of go back to what we were originally talking about, how can people from far away from these pipeline battles that are happening contribute to these struggles that are happening literally all across North America? I think for some people, watching these things unfold, they feel so far away. But I'm curious, how can people connect to these battles and also strengthen them?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, all for these pipelines specifically, if you're in the area and are able to come down to Richmond next week on December 11th and 12th and want to join us at the State Water Control Board meetings, you can hit up NoACP on Facebook or Twitter, and we can try to see what's up. Otherwise, you know, NoACP, which is a group that I work with closely, we are trying to fund a resistance bus that can go around and be a rapid response vehicle, as well as a community health project to take our medics around to impoverished neighborhoods. But so, like, that's just one specific thing that we're doing. You know, I hate to say it, but when folks ask you to call the board members and the representatives, you know, do it. Send them Facebook messages, find their Twitter, write them a letter. You know, all the public outcry does affect their decision making while we're still in that phase. Beyond that, educate yourself and learn. If you have money, you know, that always helps. But yeah, and you know, learn how to fight extraction in your own town. It's, you don't always need to travel to make a big impact. You know, I think one thing that I really like to reference a lot is Russell Maroon Schultz, The Dragon and the Hydra. You know, we need to be a movement that's more of a hydra than a dragon. You know, so I think that'll make the biggest impact and be the most effective.
Can you explain a little bit of what you mean by that?
Yeah. So in his essay, which is an essay on Black and African resistance throughout the colonies in the Western Hemisphere, he uses the metaphor, the dragon and the hydra. A dragon being kind of a single centralized force, but once you cut its head off, the body dies. So if you have one leader, let's say, or one encampment, let's say, and you kind of cut off its source, the rest of it will fall away. Whereas a hydra model, where you know, can also be thought of as death from a thousand cuts, kind of attacking and resisting from multiple angles, have a bigger impact or a more effective impact. And, you know, if one head gets cut off, you have two return in its place. So you can also kind of think of it as a death by a thousand cuts if you're talking about a pipeline struggle. And so I think it's a really good metaphor that we can use both for pipeline struggles and resistance in general.
You know, I just wanted to ask, you know, a lot of these people in reading about some of this stuff, whether it's Trump or, you know, the former governor of Virginia or any of these people, really, when we talk about them being climate deniers, in your opinion, do you think that these elites actually don't believe in climate change, or they're simply to create a smokescreen to kind of, you know, manufacture consent to acquiesce to whatever they're doing, or kind of like obscure what's going on? I mean, I'm just kind of curious your thoughts. I mean, do you actually think that they really don't believe that you know, human fossil fuel emissions are causing the climate to change?
Right. Well, in one sense, I think it depends on who we're talking about. Like, if we're talking about Donald Trump, who knows what that guy actually believes, right? He might actually just be that dumb. But when it comes to like state regulators, and even Governor McAuliffe and Governor-elect Ralph Northam, I think they believe in climate change, or at least recognize that it's real. At least with McAuliffe, you know, he's a capitalist, and I think it's more of the smokescreen. He's potentially going to try to run for president in 2020. So he doesn't want to do anything too controversial now. He's all about business, you know, always about trying to promote Virginia as a great place for business. And it's like, you know, we just want to live, trying to not die from the pipeline. So I think it's, a lot of it is that smokescreen and manufactured consent.
Going into the future, what do you think the major hurdles that the anti-pipeline movement needs to overcome?
That's a really tough question. I mean, considering the nature of pipelines in that it exists within such a heavy legal process to even go through them. So in some senses, for anarchists and anti-statists and revolutionaries, you know, there's always kind of that, you know, do I engage with the state process or do I not? So there's that aspect of it. And I think in one sense, folks have to get comfortable and learn the structures of the state, so that we can, on some fronts, use their own rules against them, which I think certain individuals have been really effective at. However, I think we also need to continue to delegitimize the state for everyone and help folks come to the understanding that the state and the police will always hurt us and never help us, and that their only interest is the accumulation of capital. You know, damn the rest. And so I think continuing to expand popular notions of anarchism, rebellion, and revolutionary politics. It's a long struggle. And a big one, big hurdle. But I think that in a lot of ways, we're on a good trend with that. 2017 has been an interesting year. So excited to see what 2018 and 19 and beyond bring.
Yeah, it's almost, you're almost hopeful, but also scared shitless. So,
yeah, you know, it's like, you know, and even thinking about my own life, it's like, how can I commit to like a personal career or anything like that just to survive when I'm also expecting to, you know, I have to continue resisting, and you know, all the implications that brings with that in terms of repression and so forth.
Right. Well, also the implications that 15 years from now, who knows ecologically what the world could look like.
Right. You know, we've blown past, what is it, 350, right? And we've blown past that. Are we at like 402 parts per million, CO2, something to that effect? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've already seen the negative feedback loops of extreme weather and climate related events, like, you know, these fucked up hurricanes and all the terrible stuff that's been happening in Puerto Rico, and the wildfires out west. You know, it's like, how do people not see this and not recognize that this is our fault? And if we only continue, we're cutting our arms off one by one, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Well, you know, we've asked several other people on this program about this, but I mean, do you have any analysis predictions? I mean, just what you think, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 years from now will look like? I mean, will we just see a continuation of what we're seeing today, and it will just get worse, you know, more wildfires, more storms? Or do you foresee that there's going to be some real curveballs that we're going to, you know, have to deal with in the next couple decades? And I guess also, you know, the other side of that is just, you know, in what ways is that a door opening for revolutionaries? Because more and more, it just seems like, I mean, especially with this tax bill, I mean, the elites have basically said, you know, sucks to be you, you know,
right.
We got our shit, you know, fuck off. And if you look at, you know, what happened with Puerto Rico, I mean, it's horrible in some instances, but it seems like more and more there is an opportunity there to just, you know, seize territory. Because at some point, I mean, how much can the state govern an area that they do not give a fuck about?
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, I think it's been really inspiring to see the emergence of all these autonomous mutual aid centers across the island, and so that's really awesome to seeing that take off. Props to mutual aid and all those folks and their partners. Man, in terms of climate, you know, curveballs are big what ifs. Who knows? Maybe there'll be a giant fire tornado that just sweeps across the U.S. and sucks up Congress. That would be crazy. But, you know, I think it's honestly, you know, it's hard to say, but I think we'll continue to see more and more hurricanes, these super hurricanes and super storms. I think these giant wildfires will continue to blaze, unfortunately. And I think it won't necessarily be one big thing or one dramatic event, but I think, as we've already started to see, it's a series of what used to be, you know, relatively normal events that may have been crappy, but now it's just like pure destruction. And I think, you know, in a lot of ways, a lot of that destruction is already built in. We're already on borrowed time. So it's not only, you know, stopping the current extraction, and emissions, but how do we begin to reverse that and contain it and constrain it in a, you know, ethical and sustainable way?
Well, to end on a, you know, positive note, let's talk about the podcast, not the It's Going Down podcast, the Pipeline podcast, End of the Line. You all have put out almost 10, or if not 10, yeah, 10 episodes. Just tell us a little bit about what it is. It's at soundcloud.com/pipelinepodcast. We will link to it in the show notes. But what is it, and what is its scope?
Yeah, so Pipeline Podcast was started by one of my really good friends and someone that I work with closely, Whitney. And episode 10 just came out 5 days ago. And it's really a story about these two pipelines, the Mountain Valley and the Atlantic Coast pipelines, but not really so much about the pipelines themselves, but the people affected by it. So they've been doing a really good job of going out and meeting all the different landowners and, you know, various affected parties, and just really getting their story, their personal stories, in terms of how they're affected and all that. But, and also really tracking the progress, if you want to call it that, of these, of the kind of legal and, procedural permitting process for these pipelines, and all the fears and hopes that, landowners and activists have. And so each episode, you know, has a little kind of theme to it: water, heart, eminent domain, tribunal, different things like that. And so they're really hoping to continue, doing this work on, you know, in their spare time, and really delve more into these stories.
Awesome. Well, hey, thanks so much for coming on. Best of luck to you. And again, if you want to hear more or see more what's going on Twitter, it's at @NO_ACP and on Facebook.com/NOACPVA. And we will have links to all that, including the Pipeline Podcast, End of the Line. Anything else you want to talk about? Any shout outs, any other resources that you want to plug?
Shout out to the River City Medic Collective. Shout out to all my homies across the continent. Let's continue to make some trouble.
Awesome. Hey, thanks so much for coming on, and best of luck to you. And we hope to be reporting good news on the struggle against all these different pipelines. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm trying to feed my family, I ain't being political. You ain't giving out money, then they look at you pitiful. You make a couple million, niggas greedy, they envy. Hey, fuck that other side, we gon' shoot up your Sprinter. I used to sell that crack and spray that Mac out that rim. Niggas running high when I throw down that window. Got a stendo and a hoodie, he can't wait till December. Got a stendo and a hoodie, he gon' shoot you on camera. Lost his faith in Jesus Christ, he praying to a bandana. Police gun his brother down, this shit too hard to handle. Loading up his chopper, he gon' show him black lives matter. Another nigga made the news, ain't nothing new. He done dropped out of school, it ain't nothing new.